Dick, most of the arcing that I've witnessed was 100,000 volts and less, but tremendous currents. And the arcing and all, it was sort of like welding, just like welding. When you look at contactors opening up under tremendous loads, it would burn. The contactors would maybe, let me see, it would be half an inch thick silver, sterling silver. They would just evaporate. That'll tell you what kind of current these things are working at. And these balls, or these arc balls that would be located right on the switch, could be as much as 10, 12 inches in diameter. And this was mostly high current stuff, lower voltages. I would say maybe 13,000 down to even 480, that type of stuff. Unbelievable arcs that would just melt everything, including the switchboards.
In that ball of ionized material that you saw, was it possible that the contact that just became vaporized is a conducting medium with high voltage across it in that airspace? Is that possibly what was going on there, John?
Absolutely, Dick. I believe the metal itself became sort of atomized, and that produced a conductive path even more conducive to more current, and that's where the damage came from. And the heat, you not only feel it on, like the sun right on your face, but in fact you get burned. A lot of guys got a sunburn from the ultraviolet, just like you do in welding. But it would be an explosive type of expansion, and when it finished, you would see the silver, the sterling silver, stuck on the metal, burnt through the paint and burnt into the metal, these little dimples all over the place. It was a mess.
I'm an exact guy on the subject.
What finally extinguished this? Did you have some of those air gun-like things that were supposed to extinguish this? And was there an expectation when that particular relay opened that you would see this arc? And was this a correction for a short circuit failure somewhere in the system, or this was normal disconnection procedure and safety going on? What was happening here, John? Go ahead.
No, these were switches that were opening under fault conditions. Normally that wouldn't happen, but the currents were not reduced before the switch opened. No protection device had tripped. I'm sure Glenn is familiar with anticipators that are just either not set right or just can't react fast enough. Some of them, like the vane types, they have inertia and it takes a little time. And in that small amount of time, and I'm talking, not even a second, Dick, less than a second, this would happen. And it was just something there was nothing you could do about it. And as far as it would extinguish itself, there was no way you would have time to try to extinguish it.
WHYY.
Joe recognized. How close were the personnel and how long was that line? Was it an inductive kickback, short? Were you seeing the inductive kickback of a transformer or a great big long transmission line? John, go ahead.
These were transformers. It was all reflective power coming back. It was a fault in the it usually happens in the transformer itself. And these were fed with groups of 500,000 cable, very heavy stuff. And sometimes it would just burn the ends of the cable off. You could not count on anything failing to protect it. It happened so quick. And as far as personnel, we had that happen when we were approximately, I was about 4 feet away. There was another guy who was about 3 feet away. Scared the hell out of you, Dick.
And I think you said you got a sunburn. Wes and Joe in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
Well, a scientist from Ohio has made a second method to produce the firebolt to use the microscopic vaporized metal or carbon particles. So they were using a low-frequency coil alone and deposited a thin film of carbon particles on the high-voltage electrode. When the voltage began rise at the end of the resonator, streamers began to form on the electrode. The current passing through the carbon film tend to rapidly heat the carbon particles. So this dissipation of power tends to quickly reduce impedance and subsequently release all of the power rapidly into the heated, say, micron-sized resistor. So the same results may be gotten by using a tip of a rubber covered cable, say 10 gauge, facilitates the pumping of the spark. That is a kind of old-fashioned rubber that is loaded with the salt. I believe John is very much familiar with that. John?
Yes, it worked like a welding rod. The insulation was sort of the flux which kept it going. Might as well pick up Joe.
W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. You got it, Joe.
And this is going back to your the other subject I asked about earlier, about the that asteroid. I think you flip right back to what you had here. 13.7 kilometers per second is the speed. And if you want to find out more interesting information on this thing, how they calculated what this thing will do if it ever hit something, put in 2005 space YU-55 space speed in Google. Come up with a lot of the second listing down has a lot of interesting data on this thing if this thing ever whacked the Earth, what it would do.
Yeah, you're holding this carrot in front of us, Joe. Give us a couple of words. If this 13.7 kilometers per second thing that I think was 400 meters in diameter, if it struck the Earth, did they say roughly how bad it would be, Joe?
Something like the thing would make a crater something like about 5.5 miles wide, 1.5 miles deep. And they mentioned some other things that gets into mentioning jewels and things like that right up your alley as far as the technical stuff. You got a computer next to you, go type it in. We're talking about 2005 space YU-55 space speed in Google. And the second hit down, I think it's planetx.com, had a bunch of interesting information on it.
To your knowledge, did they relate it to how many kilotons of TNT equivalent? Are we talking about the equivalent of a megaton bomb here, Joe? Go ahead.
I don't have the thing up right now, but something like 6.28 times 105 megaton, something number like that. I looked at it and said that's a lot of energy, you know.
Yeah, to make that bigger crater. And by the way, by 1/2, kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. A 400 foot diameter device, we can make a guess as to its mass, 13.7 kilometers per second. Think about its speed, and therefore we can come up with a kilojoules of energy. Oh, was that you, John?
Yeah, 400 meters, not 400.
Good point. So 400 meters, that's 1,400 feet in diameter. That's a biggie. And so lots and lots of energy. I've seen the diagram that NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory showed. I haven't studied it yet enough to find out where will the moon be, where will the Earth be as it goes whizzing by at 0.8 times the lunar distance. So it's going inside of the lunar orbit as far as distance is concerned. And the alignment probably is at some really crazy angle. And do we know anything about the repetition period of this thing? Is this thing going to come back in another 150 years? Does anybody know?
I think what I remember the thing seeing something like 100 years or something like that. No, not 100 years. I think the next pass would be 2026. There was a bunch of different sites that had different information on it. Some had actually moving animation that you could actually look and see where this thing is going to transverse between the Earth and the Moon and trajectory of the Earth and so forth and what this thing is going to be doing. Check it out. You'll see what we're talking about.
ET2QAQ? Yeah, NASA has talked from time to time about methods of defending ourselves from this. How would you defend yourself, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
WGB.
Sounds like a good time to start drinking, Dick. But actually, I really don't know much on this subject, but if you could throw me in at the end, I have another topic to bring up, something from last week, and I got a little bit more information on it, but I'm going to pass back to you. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, for time of neutrinos, I've got quite a bit of information I want to go through. Go ahead, John.
Dick, at the speed he mentioned, that's like from New York to California in a half a second.
30,646 miles per hour.
I think he said 13.7 kilometers per second. 13.7 kilometers. There is, what, 4,000 kilometers between New York and San Francisco, so that's a lot of seconds, John. Go ahead.
Okay, I must have gotten the speed wrong.
Yeah, I have a question to Glenn. Is it possible that Diode could be able to charge the capacitor from the single wire?
Dick, is it okay for me to pick this one up?
You go ahead, John. Glenn.
Wesley, to the best of my knowledge, if you're going to charge a capacitor, you need a complete circuit. Now, whether one wire or not is enough to complete the whole circuit, it could possibly be, but think of what's really required. You need basically a voltage generator or a current source to charge up the capacitor. It would have to go into the positive terminal of the capacitor. Then you'd have to have a return path from the capacitor back to the generator. So the circuit has to be complete. Now, whether it can be done with one wire or not, and how it's done, as long as that circuit is complete, the capacitor will charge. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Respond to that, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead. I know that one of the TQ demonstrations did appear to be operating on one wire. That's a little bit difficult to explain. Go ahead, Wes.
And two of mine. Not only TK, but two of mine. Successful one. I can make one wire, two diodes, one forward, one reverse, put the light bulb on it, and put a capacitor across. Not only capacitor is going to be charged, but the light bulb is going to light up. And two HGM.
Yeah, with antenna resonance-like phenomena, you can sometimes do an awful lot with one wire. But an ordinary power circuit, like something, like if I was trying to deliver 50 hertz or 60 hertz power with one wire, that's awfully difficult. Glenn, is it the neutrino thing with, what is it called now? The Grand Sasso National Laboratory plus CERN and the OPERA project that we're discussing? And there's some interesting information there. When you dig a little bit deeper, you find out that these guys were doing not a really crazy experiment. They were doing something that's really requiring a lot of explanation, and they're about to repeat it, as you probably know. Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Before Glenn, I'm sorry, I just shortly want to confirm. 16 kilohertz, which is the resonance frequency of the flyback transformer, that's where this phenomenon is happening. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for the interruption.
Understand. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, unfortunately, I wish it was that was what I was going to bring up, but it wasn't. But I'd like to certainly discuss it a little bit later. But the one actually I wanted to bring up was I did some asking around about residential service and basically what is the primary voltage that most of the transformers are being fed by that deliver residential power. And pretty much the uniform answer I got from quite a few ex-Wilco employees that were working in the engineering distribution department and everything, pretty much all came out to be the same answer. And they said that somewhere around the 80s, most of all of Long Island for residential, the transformers are all running pretty much at a regulated or very, very close to regulated 1350. So that's 1,350 volts with very, very few exceptions, Dick. and 13,000, nothing like that anywhere near residential. So it's, I think the number is 1350, and you know, that's basically the drop, and then that explains why, you know, the 4250 high voltages and everything all fall into play. Let me pass it back to you first, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Amazing. We seem to have a lot higher voltage than that in Dixfield. I keep getting that number every time I ask them. 13.5 line to line, 7,800 or something like that, line to ground. And it is my belief that the primary voltage going into my particular multi transformer is 7,800 volts, RMS, or something very close to it. The 1,350 would give you a lot more line drop. One particular, the A, B, and C phase going down my particular street goes for a good mile and a half. I don't think I could convey, with all that density of houses, I don't think I could convey the right amount of power at 1350 volts and convey it for 1 mile of wire. I just don't think it would support that, sir. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, believe it or not, that was the answer I got. And actually, one of the guys was Harry Thomas, and the other guy was Young. They were ex, you know, LIPA, well, Wilco employees before there was a LIPA. And basically, from what they were saying, is that residential drops into houses is 1350. You know, there again, you know, there's some industrial drops and other things like that, or, and of course, the distribution moves all over the place. In other words, when you get out to, like, major intersections and major drops, it goes up there. And he goes, but basically anything with, like, 1350 are all three-phase connections. And he goes, usually when you see the 1350, there's usually three pig pole transformers on a pole, and then a drop goes down to there into some kind of, like, industrial location, or then you have another drop, which sometimes even goes from 1350 to, like, 4 kV, basically into, like, ground-mounted transformers for, like, industrial applications. But any drop from, like, a... that goes from a house, you know, from a pole to a house of anything higher than 1350, 1350 volts is like unheard of. You know, it just wouldn't meet any of the national codes, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When the utility pole across the street from me was struck with an automobile about 15 or 20 years ago, and the one of the phases broke loose and came down to the ground while it was live, and it's dancing on the ground. And I'm watching that arcing and sparking of that lead jumping all over the place on the ground. And I'm looking at arcs that were a healthy inch long. You can't do that with 1,300 volts, sir, Glenn. I've got multiple pieces of evidence that, for whatever reason, there's a lot higher voltage being fed into my town than into your town. How about you, Glenn?
Well, as I said, if you had 13,500 volts on your pig pole transformer going into your house, if there was a single point failure anywhere in that system, everything in your house would fry, everything. So at 1350, you have a single set of insulation, and then you've got double insulation inside of your, you know, components within your house with transformers and isolation. So the system is designed for distribution at residential houses to be 1350. As of 13,500, as there's no, that would be so dangerous to Dick, I don't think that anything like that is possible. And even if you look at the distances on your transformer and the voltage spacing, that if you were to look at the voltage spacing on your transformer to the top, this is what Harry was telling me, is that you, there's no way you couldn't have enough insulators on that transformer case. And not only that, the spacing, remember, that's a metal can. You only have basically like a, in other words, for 1350, you need four millimeters of clearance to go into the can. At 13,500, you couldn't have a hole opening big enough in the top of that can to get it into a single one for 13,500. That's a lot of voltage. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Careful now, the 13,500 is line to line, 7,800. So we're talking about 7,800 going into the transformer. How many millimeters of spacing did you say is required for 1350 going into the pole pig transformer? Go ahead.
4 millimeters clearance.
So 4 millimeters of clearance will ensure that no arc over occurs at 1,350 volts, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, and 7,800 is about five times higher, so I would need 20 millimeters, I'd need 2 centimeters of clearance. I'm going to start looking at the size of the insulators on the system around my house. I think that'll give me another clue. The actual main high voltage lead going into your pole pig transformer, how long is that brown porcelain insulator in your case?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, Dick, but I know that there's like a stack of, like, you know, of insulators, and then the wire drops down into it. But I'm not exactly sure what it is. But I did ask quite a few people, and the first thing I did was I tried to look online to see if I could find anything, and all the websites kept on throwing me off. And then I just remembered, there's a few people I knew who used to work for, you know, for Loco before it was LIFA. And pretty much everyone that I knew that used to work over in the distribution engineering area of LIFA pretty much all told me the same thing, 1350, 1350. I kept on saying 13,500, and they said, no, that's off by 10.
Now, the new system is 1,350, and I think you said that's been established over the last 10 or 15 years. What did it used to be, Glenn, 2,400 or something like that?
So I think it's the line to line is that, but anyways, I think at one point it was like 1,100. So at one point they were like somewhere over 1.1, and then it was like 1.4 peak, or the 1350, I think, is pretty much what most of the residential distribution is on Long Island.
Okay. Soon to be found out. In the case of that CERN experiment, you may or may not know that there's a lot more accuracy there than we know about. A precision clock was transported from one place to the other. They know the location of the Italian site, the Gran Sasso National Laboratory. They know the location within 20 centimeters. They believe that timing has a worst-case accuracy error of 10 nanoseconds, and they're measuring 60 nanoseconds of delay. So the delay is something like 20 or 25 parts per million, way beyond normal measurement capability for error, if you know what I mean. So it is a bit of a mystery. The only thing wrong with the experiment is that Gran Sasso is 1,400 meters below ground, and neutrinos are very random in when they arrive. They were sending neutrinos by sending 20 microsecond long pulses. It was a 10 microsecond or 20 microsecond long pulses, something like one per second. And what you would do, because you don't know where during that, let's assume it was a 10 microsecond long pulse. You don't know where during the 10 microsecond long pulse that particular neutrino is going to decide to smash into your detector at Gran Sasso National Laboratory. And so you run the experiment a whole lot of times. They've made a total of one source said 15,000, the other said 16,000. So somewhere between 15 and 16,000 neutrino events were recorded. And now you average them all out to find out whether you're at the middle, the beginning, the end, or whatever of the 10 microsecond long pulse, and try to refine things to the nearest a couple of nanoseconds. They're going to repeat the experiment, because a lot of people request that they do this, by sending the pulses in 1 nanosecond intervals. In other words, each pulse will be 1 nanosecond long, separated by 500 nanoseconds. And so that is what 2 million pulses per second, 1 nanosecond long each. And now you send those kind of events and do the precise timing, and now you've got a lot more data that you can pin down a lot sharper in time. One of the things that I'm considering, let me drop, is that the method of generating the neutrinos was to take a beam of pulse, a bundle of electrons, a bundle of protons of the beam, and smash it into a chunk of carbon. And what comes out of the back end of that carbon are called neutrinos, and one of the three flavors of neutrinos, and sometimes the ones that arrive with some other flavor. But when you're making a pulse of protons hitting the carbon block 10 microseconds long. How do you know that the beginning of the pulse and the end of the pulse, as far as the proton density is concerned, is the same? On top of that, the carbon block being hit with these protons is going through some kind of local heating. As the carbon block gets heated, does that make more or less neutrinos when it gets hotter or colder? Is one thing to consider. To my knowledge, the method of dumping the beam is to pour it into a carbon block. So the method of dumping the beam and the method of generating the neutrinos is one and the same experiment. The actual 731 kilometers between the two sites means that roughly 2.4 milliseconds was the normal propagation time. And so to resolve 60 nanoseconds of error in that, as I said before, 20 or 24 parts per million, it should be very easy to resolve when the clock accuracy is very small fractions of a one part per million. So, and the clock, in one case, the clock was carried from site A to site B and then back to site A. And the confirmation is, and somebody was making a joke, well, what happens if the guy was transporting the clock and stopped at a particular restaurant and dwelled there on top of a mountain or whatever? And was there local stronger gravity at one site or the other? They were looking for all kinds of causes of the error. And I had the impression that Fermi Labs saw something of a similar nature. Wonder, anybody got any further...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Anybody got any further comments on this? It's a very interesting experiment as I see it. KQLIW listening. Was that you, John?
No, it was interesting. I believe the experiment for me was in 2007, and I think they are going to try to recreate it also.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, well, it's just a different nature. Since it's a little bit time left, if I have a one half of the fill rate, because it's two halves, I have a horizontal wind, which is like a U-shape, and then I close it with the capacitor only. Now we're dealing with the two different H and B fields of the first winding, which is 15 winds, the second winding that on the same half is 50 winds, and then I have a U-shaped one that is just closed with the capacitor, that is variable capacitor that I can tune. Now, if I try to tune that capacitor, what change it would make to the circuit?
When you operate with just the half of the U as opposed to the whole yoke?
Yeah, 90 degrees between the copper plates, let's say that because I made that U from the copper plate and the coils.
I assume the U you're talking about was the ferrite yoke assembly and half of it.
Oh, no. If you remember from the material that I have delivered to you, and you've seen that material, the last one, I took the half of the ferrite, I put the tape on it, then I put the bright just a strip of bright, and made the U shape along that half, okay, and then on the end of that I connected a variable capacitor. Then I put a tape on that, and then I wanted 50 winds, and I wanted 16 winds. Now the 50 winds was connected to 373 kilohertz, and 15 winds was connected to close to 50 hertz. Now, if I just tune that capacitor in that closed U-shape, horizontal winding, we know that we're dealing with 90 degrees between the copper plate, that bright, and the coils. Would that have any change to the circuitry?
I've heard you say the word bright a few times, B-R-I-G-H-T or B-R-I-T-E.
Yeah, this was because I wanted to use some kind of material. Could be a strip, from copper, but I used just that bright, like the coaxial, one that has a bright on it, just the long, thin piece of metal that I made a U-shape along that half of the of the ferrite. So I close it with the variable capacitor. Now, would that have, if I change the capacitor of that capacitor, would that have any change to the circuitry?
Yeah, now I realize it's the accent that confused me. It's braid. So the braid represents a very low inductance wide conductor. And the variable capacitor is on the, is connected how to that conductor, Wes?
Parallel. It's closing that U shape.
And the U shape is at right angles to the winding, is that true?
Correct, 90 degrees to both of the windings.
And everything I know says they should be thoroughly uncoupled. Whenever you have wiring that's at right angles to each other, there should be zero coupling, so that's a bit confusing.
Well, we have experienced actually that we have had a reaction of the system to that closed loop with the capacitor, because that reacts as a parallel resonance circuit, and we've had a significant change into it. So we had a two tuning factors. One of them is the U shape with the capacitor, and the other one is the bifilar core coil at the output with the capacitor, and the load at the end of it. I just wanted to confirm if you have had any similar experience.
No, I have not. As you tune the capacitor on the U-shaped structure, the braid, did you see any change? And if so, that change would be hard to explain, because being orthogonal, it should be thoroughly decoupled and have no interaction effect. Over to you, Wes.
Well, actually, it changes the output power, and significantly. The way that I did the experimentation is that I had a coil at first, or a set of coils at first, nothing connected to it. So what I did is we connected the 50 winds winding to the generator. Swooping generator. I've used the generator from the network vector analyzer, and then I was looking at the bright by itself for the peak frequency. I found the peak frequency on 1.3 megahertz. Then I disconnected the swooping generator, and I connected at that point exactly the frequency of that peak, which I've seen the peak on the spectrum analyzer. Now, when I have had that, you understand that we have a 290 degrees the magnetic field. And the approximate relation of the B and H of them. Let me jump. Now, when I connected 1.3, the resonance frequency, then I connected the oscilloscope to 50 winds. And we find out that the approximate frequency of the resonance, actually there were two findings. In my particular situation, it was 220 kilohertz, but in the other one was 373, and that was lower resonance harmonics. That was a peak. Okay. Then, what I did is, when I found that frequency, I disconnect everything, and then I connect the generator at the exact frequency that was shown at lower resonance harmonic. Then I used the 50 hertz generator connected to 15 winds. Then I was trying to tune that generator 50 hertz to the maximum output power on the bifilar. And of course, using the capacitor at the bifilar to tune the impedance of the generator to get the maximum effect out of it. And so we have had a two frequencies, close to 50 hertz and 382 kilohertz. but the lower harmonics were containing them when I was looking at the spectrum, 50 hertz and 282 kilohertz or 73 kilohertz as well. Now, the effect of that was that we were getting the output power of significant nature from the Bifilar. Then the second thing was happening is that we start to hammer the U-shape winding with the spark gap, and we've got even more significant amount of power on the output. I would like you, Dick, to just closely analyze the material that I have sent you, the last one, and I would like to ask you is, if I have undeniably working device on my table, would you come to me and examine it by yourself? And to XJN.
Yeah, you're asking whether or not I'm going to have some free time this week, for instance.
No, not this week. I'm not asking this week, next week. I'm saying is, if I have undeniably working model on my table, would you come and examine it by yourself?
And I have a question, Dick.
I think the answer is yes. All right, go ahead, John.
Dick, a little thing off subject. I'm interested in measuring the thermal noise in a billet of steel. How can I match that impedance to my receiver?
Yeah, that's a toughy one. As we discussed once before, whether your resistor is 50 ohms, 1 ohm, whether it's made out of tungsten or made out of carbon granules or whatever, once you know its physical temperature in kelvins, then you know exactly how much noise power it's making if you impedance match to it. Now, to impedance match to a chunk of steel, if you take a sliver of it and wind it into a resistor, that's one way. To take a really solid chunk of steel, which probably has a resistance from one end to the other of milliohms, and you have to choose an appropriate frequency where your receiver has got good low noise figure, to impedance match milliohms into a 50 ohm receiver, that is a challenge. But to measure radio noise, you have to have a radio impedance match at that frequency. And it's got to be a resistive impedance match, and not just using the inductance of a certain length of a steel bar. You've got to impedance match to the resistive component in order to see the random noise of the motion of those molecules and electrons. It's a toughie. I think the easiest way is to take a sliver of the steel and wind it into a resistor. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. No, I was just asking. I had a piece of railroad track about 2 feet long, and I was interested in just seeing if I could do it. But the input, I can only switch between 50 ohms and 600 on the receiver, so that's a moot point, I guess. But, yeah, I guess I could take a sample of steel, of the same type of steel, if it was small enough, try to get that resistance value up there. Okay, just thought I'd ask. Continue.
Now, John, what makes you think that the radio noise inside of the steel of that railroad rail is any different than any other sample of steel? You and I could choose a resistor that's made out of stainless steel, Monel, whatever. No matter what the resistor is made out of, once you resistively impedance match to it, it's going to give you an amount of noise directly proportional to its physical temperature in kelvins. And so I think you're saying you'd like to confirm that, but do you think there's something unique about your steel rail that its amount of noise will be different than any other material at that temperature? Over to you, John.
No, Dick, I don't think it'll be any different, but I wanted to experiment. I do have some tungsten blocks which I might be able to work with, because they're pretty high in resistance value, so I may be able to work with that if I put enough of them together. But no, I just wanted to see, and then I wanted to actually change the temperature in the room I've got some pretty accurate thermometers. And I was going to see how that noise level, I think you said it starts at negative 114 dB, and my receiver will be down to 117 negative, so I should be able to detect something.
Be careful now. When you're measuring noise power, a noise power measurement in dBm has no meaning until you define the bandwidth, the noise equivalent bandwidth, of the instrumentation making the measurement. A resistor of any value, but I'm going to choose one of 50 ohms, and assume now that I've got a low inductance 50 ohm resistor. It could be a 50 ohm dummy load that's, you know, made to go up to 4 gigahertz, and I'm making the measurement at 400 megacycles. So I've got the 50 ohm low reactance pure 50 ohm resistor, and I plug it into a receiver. And if I properly calibrate the system by radiometry technique, I will reconfirm that at room temperature it is generating minus 114 dBm per megacycle of bandwidth. If I change the receiver, so instead of having 1 megacycle of bandwidth, it has 100 kilohertz of bandwidth, 1/10 of bandwidth, I will measure 1/10 of power. 114 dBm per megacycle will become minus 124 dBm per 100 kilohertz. Per 0.1 megacycle. So noise power has got to be measured as noise power density, dBm per megahertz of bandwidth of the detecting equipment. One of them makes a little more sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, it does. And I can vary my receiver up to 3 kilohertz in bandwidth. So I should be able to play in that area.
Whoa, back off. No, you can't. If your major bandwidth is 3 kilohertz, not megahertz, 3 kilohertz, you're going to have a huge problem, what's called mu to sigma ratio. Let me show you what goes on. If I'm using a 1 megacycle wide IF strip on the tail end of a receiver, okay, I'm making the measurement at 400 megs, I've converted down to 30 megacycles of IF, and 30 meg IF is 1 megacycle wide. These are realistic numbers with a certain kind of instrumentation receiver. And now I've got a detector across that 1 megacycle. Each second, because it's got 1 megacycle of bandwidth, you could say that that crystal detector is looking at 1 million events per second. It's got 1 megacycle of bandwidth. Let me drop. So now, I've got 120 decibels of gain from the front end of this receiver into the final detector. The final detector has got this crystal diode that's rectifying, and now I've got some video bandwidth after that. In other words, I may make the video bandwidth 10 hertz, and I've got the pre-detection bandwidth 1 megahertz. So I've now got a ratio of 10 hertz to 100 megahertz. Each instant at the time of which I measure the voltage coming out of the 10 hertz video bandwidth, it's really an RC network, you know, a simple integrator, voltage integrator, you could say there's 100,000 events in there. So I'm going to get a nice smooth voltage. Now as I make the pre-detection bandwidth, the 1 megacycle bandwidth, as I make it more and more narrow, and leave everything as is, don't change anything else, because I make it more narrow, by definition it's going to see a smaller bandwidth of noise, therefore less noise power. The only way I can come back up to the same threshold is I have to plug in more gain. You've seen this effect on your spectrum analyzer. When you set your spectrum analyzer for a resolution bandwidth of 1 megacycle, you see a certain amount of noise on that screen. You suddenly flip into 100 kilohertz resolution bandwidth, 1/10 of bandwidth, and the noise on the screen moves down by 10 dB, and it becomes a little bit more ratty. And as you go down to more and more narrow bandwidth, you get less and less noise power. So in your particular detector network that I'm describing before, as you go down to a more narrow bandwidth, you have to use more gain to bring it back up to the threshold of that particular detector. Well, when I get down to 3 kilohertz, I'm now only taking 3,000 samples per second into a 10 hertz filter. I'm taking 30 samples per event, so to speak, you're going to see a hell of a lot jitter. If I was going into a Dawson Dow movement, the needle would now be dancing all over the place because I've got a very small integration factor. Noise is very noisy. You can quote me on that. Let me drop. Noise is a very noisy, very random signal. It jumps all over the place. If you've got a huge integration factor, a very large bandwidth in front of the detector, and there's very small video bandwidth after the crystal detector, you've now got a great big integration factor. You smooth out the randomness of that noise. Many of the really good radio telescopes use a receiver bandwidth of 1,000 megacycles and beyond. If they really want to have very sensitive, very little jitter in the recording, they sometimes use 1,000 megacycles of bandwidth into a 10 hertz video filter in order to get rid of this random variable. They call it the mu to sigma ratio. A mu means the mean value, sigma means the standard deviation. If you've got very little integration factor, you're going to see a huge standard deviation compared to the mean value. That's a fancy way of saying you'll watch the Dawson Dow mu dance all over the place, and it's very hard to figure out what is the value you're measuring. So to make a noise measurement with a 3 kilohertz bandwidth is going to be very difficult as I see it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, yes, that's something I didn't know. Okay, so we need more samples so the integration works out. So that's definitely not going to be. I'll have to require a receiver with much more better integration factor. Maybe I can get some at 1,000 gig, at a gig.
Now, the amount of smoothing you're going to get is a function of the ratio of the pre-detection bandwidth and post-detection bandwidth. In theory, you can use your 3 kilohertz filter, 3 kilohertz bandwidth, and detect it, and then it goes into an integrator. If the integrator had a time constant of 1 hour, 3,600 seconds, you're gonna come back to almost the right ratio. Maybe it doesn't have to be quite that long. But now it's going to take you a long time to come up to steady state reading. You can make the right integration factor if you make the video bandwidth narrow enough. You can give it a very long video time constant. But as I said, now you gotta pray that your system is not changing gain. Let's assume that you make a time constant of 30 minutes. You've got to pray that your receiver is not changing gain in 30 minutes. The event is not changing power output during 30 minutes. And you've got to wait a long time for it to come up to a steady state reading. You can see now why all automatic noise figure indicator systems run on at least 1 megacycle of bandwidth, sometimes 3 megacycles of bandwidth, so that the needle doesn't dance all over the place while you're adjusting your low noise amplifier. So making noise measurements is very different than making a signal measurement coming out of a signal generator. Noise is noisy. You can quote me on that, John. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, and during the hour of integration, the temperature is going to change in the room, too. So, yeah, that's kind of useless. But thanks for that info, Dick. I'm going to do a little more research on that. But at least I can play with resistors. They'll work for me. Basically, I can fool around with that. Just to get going. But, all right, back to you. Thank you much.
And let me show you one other problem, John. You probably wanted to measure the noise power out of your rail, and maybe it's a rail that's sitting out in the real rail, your rail rod, so to speak. And it's 70 degrees now, and an hour from now it's going to be 68 degrees, and you want to see the difference. You may not be able to see that. Remember now, the noise power is directly proportional to absolute temperature in kelvins. If I go from a room temperature of, by the IEEE standard, room temperature is defined as 290 kelvins, which comes out to something like 64 degrees Fahrenheit. I forget the exact number, but it's a little bit on the cold side by my standard. But for whatever reason, all the noise figure measurements, by definition, are referenced to 290 kelvins when it comes to noise figure measurement. Okay? If I take 290 kelvins and I now cool it part of the way with liquid nitrogen. So I go down to half of that absolute temperature, 145 degrees Kelvin, which, by the way, by your and my standards, is damn cold. 145 Kelvin is minus 100 and some odd centigrade. That's damn cold. You go that cold, you half the number of degrees Kelvin, you half the total amount of noise power. That's only a 3 decibel change. You go from minus 114 to minus 117 dBm per megacycle when you go that ridiculously cold. So once you realize what's going on here, that everything noise-wise, let me drop. Everything noise-wise is absolute degrees Kelvin. And what you and I call room temperature is 290 or 300 Kelvin. You've got to move a lot of Kelvins, which, by the way, they move as fast as centigrade. But they've got this 271 degree offset, if you know what I mean. Because absolute zero is minus 271 degrees centigrade. Because it's got this extra 271 degree offset to be Kelvins, you've got to move a whole lot of degrees before you see a substantial change in noise. And so, if your system, because of its integration factor, has a jitter of half a decibel, and you're trying to resolve a couple of degrees change in centigrade in your room, you ain't going to be able to see it. The jitter of your system is going to bury the change in noise power that you're looking for if you have that small a number of degrees Kelvin in change. You see the problem, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, and I realize that if I half the temperature in the room, that's not the same as halving Kelvin. So what I was going to do was I was going to use my torch to heat it, take it up to 1,500 or 1,800 degrees, and see if I could do something with that. But that's way in advance of where I am right now.
Yeah, the machine that they manufactured at AIL for a whole lot of years, which was considered the most significant calibration procedure for making noise figure measurements, was called the hot-cold noise source. You had these two 50-ohm resistors very carefully generated so that at your particular favorite frequency, they had a standing wave ratio of 1.001, so to speak, you know, 50 ohms plus or minus a few milliohms, and no reactance to them. So you got these two very good resistors. One of the resistors is in a vat of boiling water, 100 degrees centigrade. The other one is in a vat of boiling liquid nitrogen, 77 kelvins. So 77 kelvins is 1, and 270 plus 100 is 370. So 371 degrees Kelvin was the hot, 77 degrees Kelvin is the cold, and now these things were traceable to the bureau, so to speak. The resistors are traceable to the bureau in their impedance. The boiling temperature of liquid nitrogen is very reproducible. The boiling temperature of water, both of these are at room at standard sea level pressure. So you've got these very exact things, boiling water and boiling liquid nitrogen. You now know the exact ratio of noise power that those 250 ohm resistors are making. Let's assume now that difference was, I'm going to pick a number, 3.7 dB. Like if I took the ratio of those two numbers, I'd know right away and multiply it by minus 114. I'll eventually figure that one out for you. But let's assume that there's a 4.5 or 5 dB difference in real noise power. If the receiver you're measuring was absolutely perfect, the delta you would measure when you first plug in the hot resistor and then the cold resistor, the noise power coming out of your receiver would change exactly by that 5 and a fraction dB, whatever it was supposed to be. As the noise figure of your receiver becomes higher and higher, as the noise figure of your receiver becomes higher and higher, which is a fancy way of saying it's less and less sensitive, it means it's still going to be able to see the noise power coming out of the hot resistor, but the cold resistor is so much lower in noise power, it's not going to see it anymore. So therefore, the delta in noise power coming out of your receiver is going to get smaller and smaller as you switch from hot to cold, as your receiver gets worse and worse, higher and higher in noise figure. So the noise figure of the receiver is really how much is the front end blinded by its own source of random noise. A perfect receiver would have 0 degrees Kelvin of equivalent noise temperature. 0 dB of noise figure. It's nice to dream about that. We haven't found a way to build that yet. So every receiver you measure is going to get a delta noise power output that's smaller than the calculation. But the exact delta you get is telling you the exact noise figure of your receiver in a way that's traceable to the bureau, as they say. So that was the magic of that hot-cold noise source. But in order to get a significant delta between the two, you can tell you needed an extreme boiling water. That's not so extreme, but liquid nitrogen, that's real cryogenics by most people's standards. You touch that by mistake and you can get a freezer burn in your finger real fast. KC2 WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, I've worked with it and I know you can do some freaky things with that stuff. But that is a great system. So you could not detect the noise in the cooler resistor as the noise level of the receiver was rising. So you could actually tell, you could never get to a zero noise floor, but you could tell how close you were to it by that measurement. That's a wonderful idea. Who thought of that?
The man's name is Harvey Glass, and I worked with him for 35 years. He was one of the main inventors of that. And by the way, one of the things that he ran into, a real nasty problem, was that as you operated the hot-cold noise source for, let's say, 20 minutes...
30 seconds, Dick.
No, as you're doing a production run of receivers, and you're running this hot-cold noise source, you've got liquid nitrogen boiling away on the cold resistor for the last hour, and you're doing the measurements, and you soon realize that things start going haywire. What was happening is that the air that was inside of the 50-ohm termination that was in the vat of liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen has a temperature below the temperature at which either oxygen or nitrogen in the air will liquefy. So the air in the room is not only forming frost, but forming liquid air inside of the 50-ohm resistor, changing its impedance. Nasty problem. And Harvey had an extremely...
machine, if you want to.